Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, join me in welcoming my co-host, the Y.E. Yang of the education policy world, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
Oof, better than Tiger, and certainly better than Bob Novak.
Woo, yes. Well, that latter part is certainly true. So, yeah, I mean, who would be the Tiger Woods of the education policy community?
I mean, Tiger Woods,
sort of the favorite, the dominant player.
He's 14-0 after when he led majors after 54 holes. I mean, I can't think of anybody in education who is that consistently. I think Checker's about as close as we get.
Whoa!
Checker's pretty consistently interesting and pretty consistently thoughtful.
Yeah, and so I'm saying you're the Yang to his Yin. I'm stretching that here. So Rick, we have a special edition of the Education Gadfly Show today. You want to know why?
Why?
It's called "We're Stretching to Try to Talk About Education in the Middle of August."
That sounds pretty special.
Yeah. So we're going to bring in some topics that are tangentially related to education.
Well, but you just had a firestorm this last week, I think, on education, didn't you? You wrote about Montgomery County and ignited a hailstorm of letters.
I did. I jumped off of this new book about Montgomery County, Maryland, the Leading for Equity book, which is a Harvard Education Press book that was very laudatory about Jerry Weiss' tenure as superintendent over the last 10 years. He's still here. He's still doing the job. He makes $500,000 a year. And I think I've heard from several parents and activists in Montgomery County who are not big fans of Jerry Weiss.
Well, I mean, it is true also, as I think you noted, that he had the good fortune to do this from 1999 to 2009, which was a pretty sweet time to be sitting in Montgomery County public official.
Because housing values went up.
Ridiculously.
At least 50%, probably more. That meant property taxes went sky high, and that meant a lot of extra money to spend on things like poor kids.
Without having to take money away from affluent kids.
Right. So not quite sure how this experience is going to be so replicable. But even with all of that, there's still a lot of folks out there that are angry at him. They think he's destroyed the special ed system. They think they show that the SAT achievement gap has actually gotten bigger. But it's great. You know, it's a lot of very smart commentary. It's nice, you know, it's just nice to hear from people at a local level right here in our backyard, actually where I live, about what's going on in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So lots to cover today, even though it's August. We are going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute, and we're going to rate that reform. It's a full show today. Mickey, let's get us started.
Okay. Question number one. Let's face it. Healthcare reform is on everyone's minds right now. So here's the education angle. What do citizens need to know and be able to do to follow the healthcare debate and participate in a meaningful way? What does that apply about what our schools should be teaching?
That's a pretty good question, isn't it? See how we're working in the topical debate of the day into the education angle? I mean, okay, so let's think about what we've seen the last few weeks. There's been, for example, charges of socialism related to this healthcare. So, you know, to make sense of that, you got to have some knowledge of the history of socialism.
Death squads and eugenics have been charged.
Death squads and eugenics, got to make sense of that. I mean, but seriously, you know, you got to be able to read at a fairly high level to make sense of, you know, following a newspaper editorial about this stuff, the articles, there's a lot of dense information. You got to make sense of numbers. People are throwing around these numbers about how many trillions of dollars it's going to cost. You got to understand your own healthcare plan, as Mickey pointed out before the show, which is no small thing. I mean, you got to know a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's my question, Rick. All this talk and the common standards framework or other places about getting kids ready for college and work, doesn't that mean you could get a kid ready for freshman year of college or for, you know, a decent paying job, and they wouldn't necessarily be ready to participate in the healthcare debate?
That's true.
So doesn't that mean that we need to have a much broader notion of what it means to be well-educated?
Either that, or it means we have to have a much less grandiose notion of what government can and should do.
Oh, you mean if the healthcare system were simpler and
So for instance, one of the things that's funny to me is you see these ludicrous, embarrassing people who stand up and say, "I love Medicare. Why are you talking about a government takeover of healthcare?"
Right,
folks. Remember, Medicare is actually a government program. But the problem is, everybody operates off this default assumption that Medicare is the gold standard. Well, I thought up till about 18 months ago that we were all in agreement that Medicare was bankrupting the nation. It's gold-plated generational wealth transfer from younger and working folks to retired folks. But somehow, we don't have any obligation to talk about costs or social responsibility. Instead, people like Medicare because it gives them lots of great health care at pretty much little or no cost. Mm-hmm. Well, duh, who wouldn't like it? What I don't see when we talk about any of the standards conversations or even talk about reading and math proficiency, is how do we actually make sure that we are inculcating an appreciation for tough decisions and for responsibility?
Well said. Hey, by the way, Medicare, no longer the gold standard. Now everybody loves the VA hospitals.
Yes.
You know, on the left, there's always been an idea that we should use the schools to develop revolutionaries. Maybe we should use the schools to tell kids that they're getting screwed by the baby boomers and they should rise up in revolution. Okay, topic number two.
The Wall Street Journal reports that some school districts, such as Denver, are engaging in expensive PR campaigns to win back parents and students to their districts from charter schools. Jay Green says this proves he's right and Rick and Mike are wrong. Competition does actually work. Is he right?
Jay. Look, the fact that you can readily find superintendents who say we are eager to compete, and the fact that districts are running ads before movies in the local Cineplex or printing up handbills tells us nothing about whether or not they are being pushed by the entrance of voucher programs or charter schools to re-engineer the way they go about their work, to rethink their models, and to become more productive. I mean, the purpose of competition is not to have somebody say, I welcome the chance to compete. It is to force them to rethink the way they do business. And I don't think that these ads and these t-shirts tell us much about whether that's happening.
All right. And you know, look, and to Jay's credit, he does admit that this is not everything. This is just an indication. It's not fundamental change, but he thinks it's something. Here's the difference, though, right? I mean, you see this in any industry. If somebody comes along and there's new competition, at first, the old line companies aren't going to reinvent themselves. They're not going to fundamentally change. They're going to try to make cosmetic changes and compete in that way, right?
But these ads have been running since the mid-90s.
Out in other sectors, you've got the creative destruction, right?
Mm-hmm.
That if people don't fundamentally reinvent themselves, then the disruptive technologies, the new upfronts, we're going to take over.
Sure.
And those old companies will fade away. You know, we're just not comfortable with the Denver public schools fading away.
It's easy for the Denver Soup to find a couple $100,000 to do a bunch of ads, you know, in the cinema or print up t-shirts. It's really hard for them to say, we're going to go ahead and lay off 3% of the teacher workforce because we can deploy those dollars more effectively.
Okay, topic number three.
It looks like Wisconsin is going to get rid of its firewall that keeps student achievement data from being used to evaluate teachers. This is so the state will be eligible for Race to the Top funds. Is it time for Rick and Mike to admit that the Race to the Top is working to make important policy changes?
Never! Just kidding.
This really is more and more NCLB redux.
Yeah.
You know, NCLB had some really beneficial effects. You know, I'm happy to concede it. But the point was not that it did not encourage good things. It's that it encouraged some good things in a heavy-handed and destructive manner that over time did more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
And what worries me about, this is exactly like the same kind of over-enthusiastic coverage of the early NCLB years, when people each time state that hadn't had an accountability system adopted one, every time you could find evidence that somebody had made some progress on the achievement gap, you got excited touts about it.
Let's give credit where credit is due. I mean, it was pretty clear at one point that Congress was going to spend a boatload of money on the education system as part of the stimulus. And there was the case that was made that this was an anti-deflationary measure. And so they said, what can we get while we're spending this boatload of money along the way? And they've gone after this teacher evaluation, the student achievement data with teachers. It's pretty clean cut for the most part. Either you have a firewall or you don't. It's pretty clear that this is a political issue, not a technical issue.
Mm-hmm. What we're worried about is just like it was a good development in NCLB when states hadn't seriously treated standards or accountability made those first steps. My concern is that I don't see any intimation that the department wants to stop here.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, what could have been a really positive step could wind up getting undone and then some.
Well, that's right. And when we get into the areas that require a lot of nuance, such as turning around failing schools, then you get into a lot of trouble.
Or what do you do once you have the ability to link student identifiers and teacher identifiers.
That's right. Do you then use that in a really stupid way?
Mm-hmm.
Which they probably will.
That's the concern.
Okay, Rick. Whew, that was a lot of substance for the middle of the summer.
That's what I'm talking about, baby.
I'm picturing some of our listeners are probably on vacation in some lakeside villa, and they got their
we're sparking the synapses,
earphones
baby.
On, and here they are. Yeah.
Fighting summer learning loss.
Whew, they are. I'm telling you, we're gearing up for back to school.
That's good. It's good.
Okay, and we're going to contribute to that now with Amber's Research Minute. How's your summer going?
How you doing? It's going great.
How's
you're
your tan
very
coming
summery.
Along?
I'm losing my tan. Losing my tan.
Gotta, you look summery.
Gotta bring
I like
the bottle
the
out again.
I like the
spray, the spray on stuff.
Oh yes. Yes. Don't, I can't deal with wrinkles. You know, sun just gives you wrinkles, and you got to be worried about that at my age now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, y'all don't know. What to,
know
what you don't know what to do with that, do you? Let's just.
I'm older than you. I look every day. I go, my God, I used to have such clear, I'm kind of fresh-looking skin.
Yes. Okay. Well. We're all old. We're all getting older.
Yes,
but,
we are.
But you know what's not old is the research you're about to report on. It is fresh.
It is fresh and new, and it is out this week by the Manhattan Institute and our friend Jay Green. He examines whether special education vouchers in Florida reduce the likelihood that public schools will identify students as mildly disabled. The thinking is that schools might have a perverse incentive to identify students as disabled since they get more money to educate them, and sometimes it doesn't cost as much as the subsidy amount to educate them anyway. So, he finds that voucher competition decreased the probability that 4th through 6th grade students would be newly identified as disabled by about 15% for school year 05-06. Couple drawbacks to the study, however. One is that the disability diagnoses are typically made before 4th grade, and he didn't have data prior to 4th grade. That said, he hypothesizes that the study findings might either mean A, voucher programs help ensure that students are not misdiagnosed, or B, that schools respond to the risk of losing funding by failing to diagnose students who really should be diagnosed. Given the sharp increase in the number of students classified as needing special ed, these not exactly unbiased observers think it is the former, meaning that schools' voucher programs help ensure that students are not misdiagnosed. End of study.
Whew. Okay. First of all, shout out to Jay.
Shout
giving
out
us a
to
lot
Jay.
Of good content
mm-hmm.
for this week.
Yes,
a lot of content, especially for a height of the summer.
He did.
That's right. All right. So, Rick, what do you think about this? Are you convinced?
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Unconvinced.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, but unconvinced. So this,
but not convinced.
Well, this argument's been around a long time that mm-hmm. school districts are identifying kids to go after the money. But so call me a little bit unconvinced. I mean, don't you think it's much more likely that it's really parents that are the drivers of this?
Yeah, but Jay says it's not parents that drive it. It's the schools that drive the identification. He said outside of D.C., you know, which parents have more control.
I mean, the problem is it's really, you know, it's really interesting kind of research angle. The problem is it's kind of a black box question. There's a lot of moving pieces. We don't know how much of this is parents. We don't know how much of this is schools. We have new good ways to kind of unpack the different motivations. So what we can look at is what happens, but understanding why it's happening
right.
is
But,
is
but
tough.
Has anybody looked, I mean, I'd just be curious. You say Jay thinks it's the schools. I mean, mm-hmm. is the idea that in most cases the school contacts a parent and says, hey, we think your child, you know, maybe should get special ed services,
yeah.
is not the other way around?
Well, I think it depends on socioeconomic
yeah,
circumstance.
Me too.
I think in Montgomery counties, it's much more frequently the parent right. contacting the school.
Right. That's what I would think. Okay. So you're talking yeah. about, in the voucher context, we're talking about poor kids. These are systems serving mostly poor kids. And so those systems.
Yeah, these aren't parents who know how to work the system for the most part.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Yeah.
Pretty straightforward stuff.
Well,
yeah.
there you have it.
It's
so
interesting.
Yeah, interesting. So what's the song that goes
the
along
The song,
this?
Since sometimes more money can mean more problems for schools, we have Mo Money, Mo Problems by Notorious B.I.G. featuring Puff Daddy. Puff is coming up. Oh, we
you
didn't
know,
get very much, did we?
No. But I think Notorious B.I.G. would be a good nickname for Rick, don't you think?
Biggie.
All right. Thank you, Amber, for your research minute. She brings it every week.
I'm pretty sure Puff Daddy is now P. Diddy, if we're going to be technical. It's true. We should call him P. Diddy, formerly known as Puff Daddy.
But one day he's going to be Sean Combs again. He'll decide when he's like 53 that this was all a little embarrassing.
By the way, speaking of musicians, you know, did you follow the Axl Rose gate that happened on our blog last week?
No.
We'll tell you about it after we hear this music that introduces Rate That Reform. So, Stafford, welcome to the show. Do you want to tell our listeners what happened with the whole Axl gate?
No, not particularly, actually. Uh-huh. And I am giving you the death stare across the podcast right now.
All right. So basically, look, we had made a spelling error actually the week before in the Education Gadfly. Mm-hmm. It was Villaraigosa. We misspelled his name. We mixed up a G and an R. Stafford very cleverly in our errata made a G and R reference to Guns N' Roses.
I did.
And mentioned Axl Rose and misspelled his first name.
How'd you spell? You put an E in there?
I put an E in there. And then Andy caught me and would not let it go.
That's right. Our frequent guest host here, Andy Samara, called her.
I have to say, to my credit, Mike, you edited the Gadfly and did not catch the spelling mistake.
Well, and you know what? Chinese Democracy may be the only album they've released in your lifetime.
When was Chinese Democracy released?
Last year.
Oh, okay. See,
but
this is all I know about
back. Use your illusion one and two. You know, I saw them on tour in Baton Rouge in about 90, give or take.
That was awesome. The height. The 90. That was
they right were there. They were killing it, man.
Yeah. Okay, Stafford. What reform are we rating today?
Shockingly, I actually have a real story today. I'm like,
you've been making them up.
Well, okay, a real reform rather. Mm-hmm. It's not a new issue. But the Texas House Bill 1287, which was passed in 2007, has not been implemented until this fall. And it has generated a lot less controversy than us PC Washingtonians would guess. Starting this September, Texan schools will be required to teach the Bible. Though the details are scant, it seems the provision treats the good book as a work of literature. And John Keeling, chair of social studies at White House High School, explains, the purpose of a course like this isn't even really to get kids to believe in it, per se. Side note, thank God. It's just to appreciate the profound impact it has had on our history and our government. It seems like kids are just running into a lot of biblical references. So thinking about this issue is a matter of framing, obviously. So we've got either it's religion in schools or cultural literacy. As the former, I would personally be 110% against that. But despite the fact that this story is from the heart of the Bible Belt, my sense is that it's the latter. So in terms of thinking about the problem here, namely a lack of cultural literacy about a book that is arguably the cornerstone of the Western canon, addressing this issue is probably important. Think about the mentions of God in the main documents of the American government, or even on our money, or common phrases like prodigal son and David and Goliath. In terms of execution, though, I'm going to have to withhold judgment. First of all, I don't have enough information, and my sense from reading the one teeny little article I found about this was that they're not just teaching it as literature. But alas, we will have to wait until we find out what will happen in Texas.
So this has been debated, as you said, since 2007, and there's even a textbook out that's been out for a couple of years now on teaching the Bible as a piece of literature or history.
There's two things here. First, the Bible is the most widely read book in the history of mankind, so it's kind of peculiar that when you look at the roster of stuff that we have kids read, Billy Budd and on, that we don't read Bible. And two, I'm not sure what it means to teach it just as literature. When kids read James Baldwin, I think there's very few teachers who are careful not to enumerate the principles or the values that Baldwin was espousing, right? The fire next time or something. They actually talk about what Baldwin meant. So it's funny to me that, when we think about the raft of ideals and values that get addressed in schools, that we bring this particular lens of scrutiny only to the Bible.
Mm-hmm. This one's going to end up in the courts, don't you think?
I think it's very likely.
But I think there's a difference between explaining that it's a religious text and explaining the morality behind it and saying that that morality is correct or that one should believe in it.
Yeah, and look, and already I remember in high school learning about, the Reformation and some of these, and you had to get into some of the specifics about what they were arguing about. And so you were certainly studying the different tenets of different religions.
Although it's interesting, right? Because when we read, when we have kids, say, study environmental questions in high school, there's certainly many kind of self-proclaimed agnostics out there who do or are very clear that they think about these kinds of issues as spiritual in nature. And generally, when teachers approach questions like green living with a spiritual focus, they get awards for being impassioned teachers rather than rather than dinged for behaving inappropriately. So I just think, I think there's levels of complexity here that we tend to avoid simply because we label some stuff religious and let other things kind of go unobserved.
All right. Thank you, Steph. A very serious and
I know. I was shocked that I found a story in August.
Good stuff. All right, man.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.